April 5th, 2018 was just another Thursday at Mount Ida College in Newton, Massachusetts. Its 1,500 students shuffled into 9 a.m. classes, prepared for their upcoming finals, and studied late into the evening. But when they woke up the next day, their school no longer existed. Needless to say, no one expected this 119-year-old institution to permanently close its doors, never mind by email, on a random Friday in April. Professors had already signed contracts for the following year. Hundreds of students had committed to attending, and many more were left stranded midway, having accumulated tens of thousands of dollars in debt and having spent years of their lives working toward a diploma they would never receive. As abruptly as this news was delivered, however, the underlying problem has been years in the making. Across the nation, college enrollment has been on a steady decline since 2010, leaving schools short on funding. These days, a college closes about once a week. In fact, in a cruel twist of irony, a few Mount Ida students transferred to Newbury College, just 15 miles away, only for it to shut down the very next fall. And yet, this was the era of record-high high school graduation rates, of feverish pleas from the left and right alike to send your kids to college, at any cost. And things are about to get a whole lot worse, starting next year. The vast majority of college students are under 25, and America is running low on under 25-year-olds. Between 1990 and 2007, the average size of an American family stayed right between about 2 and 2.1 children. From start to finish of this entire nearly 20-year period that saw the end of the Cold War, 9/11, and the bursting of the dot-com bubble, that number changed by less than 2%. Then, in 2007, it suddenly began to fall, precipitously, and it's been falling ever since. Well, it's now been 17 years since 2007. Which means that smaller cohort of babies is now 17 years old. Next year, most will attend college, and each successive class will be smaller than the last. Over the next 5 years, the number of new students enrolling at U.S. universities is expected to fall by 11%, according to Dr. Nathan Graw of Carleton College. That's a decrease of nearly 300,000 people a year. Which may not sound like a lot, but consider that a third of U.S. universities have less than 1,000 students, and 75% fewer than 5,000. In other words, what was once a regional problem is about to spread nationwide. And this is just one of many ways America's declining birth rate will ripple throughout the country and the world. Now, U.S. universities were already on shaky financial ground, setting the stage for the current crisis. More on that another time. But they aren't alone. Other fragile business models and social structures are waiting to be exposed, vulnerable, as we've seen, even to relatively slight demographic changes. Some call this an existential crisis. Others, an environmental triumph worthy of celebration. Fewer people, after all, means fewer polluters. But before we can characterize this trend as good or bad, we first need to solve a mystery, one too often ignored by both sides. Why have birth rates fallen? And why so suddenly, yet so persistently, after 2007? Brought to you by Nebula, home to original series like the travel game show The Getaway, featuring six of your favorite creators as contestants. Dracula's Ex-Girlfriend, a dark comedy film by Abigail Thorne, and many other high-budget exclusives. Depending on who or what one is inclined to blame, there are two basic stories you can tell about birth rates. The first is economic. It doesn't take an eagle eye to notice that 2007, the year births began to fall, was also the start of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Within a year, the US unemployment rate doubled, from 5 to 10%. And it stands to reason that these millions of laid-off Americans would have more pressing concerns than starting a family, like finding a job or going back to school. This is not groundbreaking stuff. Demography 101 teaches that economic downturns lead to a steep drop in fertility. The only thing is, it usually bounces back. You lose your job, so you postpone your plans. Later, you find a new one, so you make up for lost time, causing a corresponding bump in fertility. That's exactly what we saw, for example, during and after the recent pandemic. But that's not what happened after 2007. Now, in fairness, the economic recovery was gradual and uneven. Meanwhile, what categories of expenses have grown most unaffordable over the past 20-odd years? Housing, a 95% increase, childcare, 120%, college, 180%, and healthcare, over 200%. All costs associated with children. Is it any wonder Americans are having fewer? Still, there must be more to the story. If money were the only obstacle, giving parents more would have a significant effect, particularly for the less well-off. Both Republicans and Democrats have proposed doing just that. And dozens of countries around the world have tried baby bonuses worth thousands of dollars or more. But they don't seem to make a huge difference. At least, not at the amount voters or politicians have been willing to spend. According to one estimate, it would cost the United States $250 billion each year just to increase the average family size by 0.2 children. All this leads credence to the second story you can tell about declining birth rates. Culture. It should go without saying that the world has changed quite a bit over the last 100 years. And it's not hard to imagine how some of these changes might affect the size and shape of families. Take gender roles, for instance. Not so long ago, women were almost universally expected to stay home and care for children. Today, they're freer than ever to leave, if they want to, and pursue careers. In fact, the pendulum has swung so far in the opposite direction that being a stay-at-home mom is often stigmatized. Child rearing has also become far more time and resource intensive. In an earlier era, parenting was a passive state. To be a good one meant merely setting the stage for the child's natural, independent growth. Kids played pickup games, walked to school alone, and biked aimlessly around the neighborhood with their friends. Today, the dominant, socially validated style of parenting has transformed into an incredibly active, hectic, stressful, and never-ending verb. Now, parents sign their kids up for sports. Parents organize playdates. And because many families live in isolated, car-dependent suburbs, parents pick their kids up and drop them off, shuffling them between swim and baseball and chess and piano. Every day, every season, every year. Not only is this remarkably time-consuming, not to mention ungodly expensive, but it's fraught with judgment. Parents must carefully navigate a rapidly changing, high-stakes social minefield. Keeping up with the Joneses is no longer about boats or cars, stereos or handbags. It's about summer camps, violin instructors, honors programs, and soccer leagues. But unlike the status games of yesteryear, you can choose to opt out of these, simply by not having children. Finally, because of their focus on organized sports and activities, parents have lost much of their autonomy. Their schedules revolve around the whims of coaches, tournaments, tutors, and teachers. Meanwhile, many people are increasingly anxious and pessimistic about the future. Every parent wants their kid to have a better life than their own. and for any number of reasons, many are less confident they will be. Clearly, there's something to both the economic and cultural explanations. Still, one can't help but wonder which is more important, and why the sudden drop after 2007. Well, it turns out you can get a long way by just asking people. Imagine that. Fortunately, Gallup has been doing exactly that since 1936, and the results will probably surprise you. What you're looking at is the average answer by a large representative sample of Americans over 87 years to the question, what do you think is the ideal number of children? Let's start by just looking at the shape of this line. The first thing you'll notice is that aside from this late 1960s post-baby boom adjustment, it really hasn't changed all that much. Sure, the average has gone down, but it was steady for the first 30 years and it's been steady for the past 50. Americans today answer exactly as they did in 1980, with very little fluctuation in between. Now, let's reveal the numbers. For all the talk of double income, no kids, of proud child-free millennials, and spoiled only children, the average American still thinks 2.7 kids is ideal. And remember, these are averages. Believe it or not, nearly as many want at least 3 kids as 1 or 2. If trends continue, those favoring just 1 or 2 will soon be outnumbered. In other words, it should be clear that what people consider normal or ideal doesn't change very often. We've only had one downward shift, and that was over 50 years ago. The supposed radical revolution in attitudes among younger generations doesn't exist. Get this, only 2% of Americans said 0 children is ideal in 2023, exactly as many as in 2013, and 1997, and 85, and 77. If anything, the average ideal family size has slightly increased in recent years, even as actual birth rates have fallen. What has changed is people's ability to fulfill those ideals. Recognizing their own limitations, the average American aged 15 to 44 intended to have half a child less than the 2.7 ideal between 2013 and 17. And naturally, because we live in a world of scarcity, and because life doesn't always turn out how we imagined, the average American woman only actually has 1.7 children, another half child less than she intended. At each step of the way, barriers prevent us from having as many children as we want. And those barriers have been growing. Since 2007, the gap between what we want and what we get, desired versus actual fertility, has tripled. Now, this may sound like a victory for the economic explanation and a defeat for the cultural one, but not so fast. No theory, of anything really, is complete without mention of home prices. Housing, after all, is the single largest cost associated with kids. They typically require an extra bedroom, they draw families to the suburbs, and place a premium on school districts. Needless to say, housing has gotten a lot more expensive, particularly over the last few years. In January 2019, the average size of a mortgage was $300,000. 3 years later, it was $440,000. Unsurprisingly, economists have found a negative relationship between both housing prices or interest rates and fertility. In a 2018 survey, 4 of the top 5 reasons Americans said they weren't having more kids were financial. So, yes, money. Of course, money. But as housing was becoming less and less affordable, something else, something far more subtle, was happening at the same time. Whereas having children was once a parallel process to one's education, career, and marriage, it has now become, for many, a sequential one. Americans today, remember, want more kids than they have for 44 years. but they want them after they've gone to school, after they've started their career, after they've gotten married, and after they've bought a house, as a kind of capstone to life. In other words, starting a fulfilling career, getting married, and owning a home have become prerequisites for many Americans, at precisely the moment that achieving those prerequisites has become far more difficult. And this is closely related to that highly demanding style of modern parenting. As the bar for what a, quote, good parent looks like has grown, some would say impossibly and unreasonably high, it only makes sense that young people would take much longer to get there. So, is this an economic change or a cultural one? Well, both. But more accurately, it's the interaction between them. When your friends, siblings, and colleagues have fewer children for economic reasons, you likely will too, for cultural reasons. Therefore, as the demographer Lyman Stone has said, it doesn't make much sense to disentangle them. During the Great Recession, see GDP, Americans lost their jobs, see unemployment. So they moved back in with their families, see the share of young people living with a parent. So they had a harder time starting relationships, see the marriage rate. In 1970, there were 86 marriages per 1,000 unmarried Americans aged 15 and up. Today, there are just 30. Meanwhile, without jobs, they couldn't save up for a house. Each of these things acted as a filter, first by lowering birth rates directly, preventing some from progressing at all, and then indirectly, because even among those who made it, their progress was delayed, eventually so late that they pushed up against the biological fertility window. The median American woman now gets married at 28 and has her first child at 30, up from about 24 and 27, respectively, in 1990. Now, obviously, not everyone gets married or buys a home before having kids. Many don't, and this isn't about what all Americans do or should do. It's simply an observation that as an increasing share of the population has internalized this pattern, and as progressing through it has become harder, it's no wonder they're having fewer children. Some may argue that this too is ultimately just a shift in culture, that more Americans are choosing not to get married, or waiting longer to do so. Certainly, that's part of the answer. Marriage rates are down even for the top 20% of earners, suggesting that it's not all about money. Still, marriage is down far more for both the middle class and poorest Americans, suggesting that yes, much of it is about money. None of this should be surprising. For decades, we were taught exactly this: to hold off on having a child until we graduated high school, got a job, and got married. In that order. This directive even has a name, the success sequence. So, what did Americans do? They waited to have kids. The elephant in the room is that about 40% of the decline in birth rates over the past three decades has been driven by just one thing: fewer teenage pregnancies, about half of which were under 18. As we've seen, some of the other reasons have been strictly negative: unaffordability, hopelessness, and the pressures of modern parenting. But many have been positive: expanding freedoms and opportunities for women, for example. As their wages and treatment in the workplace have improved, the opportunity cost of having children has grown. As trade-offs change, so, naturally, will decisions. And let's not forget that a small, though very real, subset of the population truly doesn't want kids, and is now freer than ever to do as they please. These are good things. The challenge today is to recognize the obstacles we face without throwing the baby, if you will, out with the bathwater. To address the issue without undoing the progress that's already been made. Declining birth rates will reshape the country, often in unexpected ways, as we're already seeing with college closures. At the same time, America is uniquely well-equipped as a country to sail through these turbulent waters. First, recall that the U.S. fertility rate sits at 1.7 children. That's less than the 2.1 needed to maintain a stable-sized population, all else being equal. But it's far higher than Russia's 1.4, Finland's 1.3, Spain's 1.2, or Hong Kong's 0.7. Second, all else is not equal. The United States has one major advantage that none of the others do. It has a long, storied history of taking in immigrants. It has a large population that makes assimilation easier, and English is the dominant language. Now, make no mistake, immigration is no silver bullet. It's no substitute for making housing or healthcare more affordable, for instance. And to claim otherwise only demonizes immigrants who are themselves victims of those very same issues. Still, if nothing else, it does buy us time and offers a buffer. People from all around the globe want to come here, and that's a luxury we shouldn't take for granted. Third, Americans still yearn for larger families. And that too is more than can be said of many places. So often in these debates, the US is thrown in with every other country, or at least every other rich one. And it makes sense. By taking a step back, we can see that the global fertility rate has been cut in half over the past six decades, from 4.7 children in 1960 to 2.3 today. As countries as far removed as France, Japan, Kenya, and the Bahamas have become wealthier, their families have almost invariably grown smaller. Clearly, there's something bigger going on here. Even before that earlier era we mentioned previously, when children were largely left alone to develop independently, they were seen as investments. They worked on the farm, helped out with household chores, and began apprenticeships as young as 6 or 7. Thus, children have transitioned first from assets, productive generators of wealth, then to something more neutral, liabilities to be sure, but relatively self-sufficient ones, and third, to high-maintenance, high-cost projects to be carefully managed. In the process, the role children play has evolved from a means to an end in itself. At the same time, healthcare has improved. As more people survived into adulthood, families adjusted accordingly. Finally, everyone migrated to cities, where space is harder to come by. All these forces pushed fertility down across cultures and continents. Thankfully, these are one-way roads. Few places manage to go backward in time, migrating away from cities, abolishing child labor laws, or losing medical progress. Therefore, few countries have managed to undo these long structural downward trends in fertility. On this point, the US is indeed not unique. Changing what Americans consider normal or ideal would be as painfully difficult here as anywhere else. In any case, it's unclear whether the state's proper role is to interfere with its citizens' private lives in this way, deliberately shaping their preferences. But that's not the issue. The average American still wants 2.7 children. Minds need not be changed. Unfortunately, this means we can't just apply a band-aid. Handing out baby bonuses is not nearly enough. Though we may still want to do that for other reasons. Recall that the COVID-era stimulus checks made the childhood poverty rate fall to a record low. We can't, in other words, simply convince people to have kids with a few thousand extra dollars. Fortunately, however, we don't need to. Unlike much of the world, our problem, particularly since 2007, is one of ability. We should be less concerned about 2.7, the ideal, whose origins are structural and difficult to influence, or 1.7, the actual fertility rate, which is merely a symptom of underlying barriers. and we should be more concerned about the large and growing gap between them. The millions of children that Americans want but are unable, for whatever reason, to have. If Americans had exactly as many kids as they already want, the country's population would grow by an entire UK, France, Germany, or 2.5 Californias in a single generation. What we have is not a birth rate crisis, per se, but a housing, healthcare, education, and childcare crisis. Which means we can kill two birds with one stone. We can make housing more affordable both for its own sake and to enable aspiring parents to fulfill their goals. But to do so, to take advantage of America's aforementioned strengths, we first have to acknowledge those birds. To truly see how good America has it, it helps to see, by contrast, the dilemma China now finds itself in. America's actual birth rate, 1.7, is China's ideal birth rate. In the former case, 1.7 represents a low point, the current state of play before serious attempts to raise it. In the latter case, 1.7 represents an upper limit, the maximum any attempt to alleviate barriers is likely to achieve in the short term without coercion. Speaking of coercion, it's often assumed that because the one-child policy was so effective at preventing births by force, the Chinese government will be able to seamlessly apply the same heavy-handed approach again, this time to raise the birth rate. But this assumption is rooted in a deep-seated myth. In reality, the one-child policy was never nearly as effective at preventing births as it was at inflicting needless suffering. And this is a pattern we see time after time. Because so little is known about China outside the country, we often take the government's boastful exaggerations at face value, like that it prevented 400 million births or lifted 800 million people out of poverty. We still criticize these policies, of course, but in the process, we accidentally launder the Chinese government's grandiose claims about its competence. That, yes, these policies were cruel, but they were also effective. The result is a distorted view of how it works and what it's capable of. That's my goal for China Actually, my original series, to take a closer and more nuanced look at some of those claims. And it's exclusively available on Nebula. Nebula, as we like to joke, is kinda like Netflix, but for people who love trains. If you like these videos, you're going to love what we're making over there. Just this summer, we released big, ambitious new series like the travel game show The Getaway, featuring six creators you may already know as contestants. Dracula's Ex-Girlfriend, a dark comedy film by Abigail Thorne, new episodes of Real Life Lore's Modern Conflicts, and much more. One series that I'm personally especially excited about is Tom Nicholas's upcoming documentary about baby boomers, which I expect will touch on some of the same topics as this video. Nebula is an ad-free premium viewing experience. Because you're our customers, not advertisers, our iOS, Android, and smart TV apps are built from the ground up with users in mind, not as afterthoughts to the website. To get an annual subscription for 40% off, that's $36 a year or just $3 per month, use the link in the description or on screen now. That's go.nebula.tv/polymatter. Alternatively, if you're not a fan of subscriptions, you can also use the link below to get lifetime access for $300.